Hi, everybody. It's John Jenkins, senior editor of DealLawyers.com, and I'd like to welcome you to my first foray into podcasting. As you know, I've done plenty of webcasts, and if you subscribe to the CorporateCounsel.net, you know that I'm a regular participant in Dave Lynn's Deep Dive with Dave podcast, where we review the current issue of the Corporate Counsel. But I've never led one on my own. So when our managing editor, Liz Dunshee, suggested the idea of hosting a podcast to me, I was a little nervous about it. And my nerves were compounded by the fact that we've just invested in a new software package to do podcasts. And I'm not exactly an IT wizard. Okay, I have training on this, but I'm not an IT wizard. So I was game for hosting a podcast, but I was a little bit concerned about making myself look like a complete idiot while doing it in front of an experienced M&A lawyer or deal maker. Then I was watching the Manning cast on Monday Night Football, and an idea occurred to me. What if I found an M&A lawyer who already thought I was an idiot? With that as background, I'd like to introduce you to a guy with 30 plus years of experience as a capital markets and M&A lawyer, former law firm partner, director of Lakeland Industries, the general counsel and chief development officer of Transcat Inc., which is a NASDAQ listed company. Lakeland's NASDAQ listed as well. And he's also dabbling in the SPAC biz as director of a recently public SPAC. So not only does my guest have all of those tickets, but I can assure you that he's been convinced that I'm a blithering idiot for more than 50 years. Without further ado, I am pleased to welcome my brother, Jim Jenkins.
Pleased to be here, Jim. John. Thanks for having me. And, you know, it's, you know, you mentioned the Mannings, so we'll just view ourselves as the less talented Mannings brothers. How about that?
That works for me, Jim, and it certainly is fair comment. And the much poorer Mannings as well. But so anyway, as I said, Jim's got a lot of experience in a whole bunch of areas, and I think it's be interesting for our members because he has about as broad a background as you can get. He was in private practice for a little more than 30 years, transitioned over to serving as an in-house role. Chief Development Officer, M&A acquisitions role for a public company about a year and a half ago, Jim?
That's about right, yep. About 16 months ago, John, yep.
So so I think that I've got a number of questions that I'm going to ask Jim, and hopefully you'll find his insights interesting if you're whatever side of the table you're on, and hopefully helpful to you as you work on your own transactions and represent your own clients. So, Jim, first thing, why don't you tell us a little bit about Transcat and your positions with the company?
Sure, John. So Transcat provides calibration services to a number of different industries, primarily in the life sciences, biomed, medical device industries. About 60% of our revenue in our calibration services business is in that. We also provide services to the aerospace, avionics, and then general industrial space. If you've got a manufacturing facility and you've got an instrument in that facility that's measuring something, it needs to be calibrated, whether it's a weight, whether it's something designed to provide for a pipette in a vaccine. You need those types of services. It's about probably about a $4 billion market at this point in the U.S. A third of it is held within OEMs internally. We're seeing more and more of that movement away. And we've also sort of started to look at ancillary businesses as well. We've also got a distribution business that we started as a distribution company off the heels of being a manufacturing company. And that distribution business is still probably about 45% of what we do. It has a nice synergy with us because we sell an instrument through a distribution process. And before we give it to the customer, we say to that customer, hey, do you want this calibrated before you take it? That way you don't have to take it internally and calibrate it yourself and spend the money and time to do that. That generates a significant increased margin for our distribution business. I mean, let's face it, in distribution, you know, it's the Grangers and the Amazons of the world that are the big players. And we feel like we have a value add on that. And we recognize it's not a huge growth part of our business, but it's a nice ancillary part that feeds our calibration growth. And great. You know, we started about 10 years ago on an acquisition strategy. I was their outside general counsel for 20 years, joined when they were kind of struggling, had a going concern opinion, had about a dollar stock price, got the delisting notice from NASDAQ, was there with them as they moved through and turned the company around. A new growth guy came in about 2010. He's my current CEO. And he likes to call this process my 10-year interview because over the course of 10 years, we became very good friends and trusted colleagues. And consequently, here I am.
Well, that's great. Now, you mentioned that you've been their outside counsel for 20 years. Maybe just a little bit on your background before you came in-house.
Yeah, so I started at a law firm that really was my only really real job. I came out of law school in 1989, joined Harder, Secrest, and Emery, and started actually as an environmental lawyer. Converted over to securities during the dot-com boom, where we were doing a lot of SEC and public M&A work, and was really there for 30 plus years, 20 as a partner, 25 as a partner, I think. Came to know and really in my wheelhouse was sort of the transcats of the world, the folks that where I would call them almost microcap at the time. That was sort of my strong suit. I sort of gravitated to it. And let's face it, a law firm in Rochester, New York is not exactly what I call like a capital markets a haven. So we took what we could get when we were doing our securities work and M&A work. And at the time, Transcat was one of those clients, and we managed to grow with them. And, here I am as a result of that. I'm very grateful. I'm very happy that I'm here.
Great. So now you've had some time to settle in to your new job, and you've gotten to travel the country in a pandemic, and have about 80 COVID tests.
I have a much larger nose than I did before COVID.
But I'm sure the National Guard, the New York airports, know you by your first
name
now. They do.
They absolutely do.
Well, anyway, this may be a tough question in light of that prologue to it. But what do you like most about your job, and what's your least favorite part of it?
Well, we're still kind of in the honeymoon stage, but I will tell you what I've really enjoyed the most about this job is I have had an opportunity to meet some really interesting people over the course of the last 15 or 16 months. If you're remotely disaffected about the American dream, if you do M&A for a public company and you buy something from someone who started his or her business in a garage and you're cutting them a check for $10 million, it's a pretty fun experience to be a part of. So that's what I enjoy the most. Probably what I enjoy the least about it at this point is really, and that's sometimes that's not exactly the right way to put it, I guess, is I miss interacting with my fellow lawyers. I'm on my own over here and in an island, and obviously I can reach out to my friends and former counsel and current counsel, but I do miss the interaction that I would often get just hanging out in an office and bouncing ideas off of really smart people.
Well, you and everybody else at this point, of course, even those of us who are still in law firms haven't seen most of our partners for the last year and a half.
That's a good point.
Other than the Zoom meetings and emails.
That's right.
Anyway, so, our membership is pretty diverse. We have folks from law firms, we have folks from the in-house world, and we have folks who are looking to transition from one to the other at some point, or at least thinking about it. So I think it might be interested in your perspective on the biggest differences between private practice and your role as an in-house counsel.
Yeah, I think a couple things I didn't realize would happen when I became general counsel was that I became everyone in the entire company's lawyer. I have a, hey, do you mind taking a look at my real estate contract for the house I want to purchase? Do you mind taking a, my mom has a will. Can I bounce something off of you? So that was something that I wasn't quite used to. And then of course, I think as I mentioned earlier, I'm on an island in a lot of ways, and I don't have other lawyers that I rely on a daily basis. When I spot an issue, I try to resolve it internally, but Oftentimes it's outside of my area of expertise, particularly things like.
Jim, are you a sole? Are you the entire law department? Do you have anybody else?
It's myself, and I have two paralegals that I worked with when I was at Harder, and they had gone off to other locations. But I knew that when I took this job, I wanted to hire them. They would be my first hires. But yes, I am the solo practitioner general counsel right now for a company that's about $200 million in revenue. So I would envision as we grow that I would grow the staff and have the opportunity to do that. The other thing I'm starting to take on things that I never really anticipated I'd take on, things like safety and compliance are things that I dabble in, and I want to make sure that when I've got major issues, it's very easy for me to pick up the phone and call. Sort of not having that backstop that you often have at a law firm is particularly when you're starting to grow out a general counsel role it can be a little scary. I will also say though, it's really exciting because I get to invent what I do, and I have an incredibly flexible management team and an incredibly flexible CEO and an incredibly supportive board of directors. So that has made my life a lot easier.
I mean, you may have already touched on this. You know, we talked about the biggest differences. If you had to identify something as being kind of the hardest part of making the transition, what would it be?
It's probably making judgment calls on areas of the law that I frankly am only have only as a corporate lawyer been tangentially involved with. So that would probably be the toughest thing. I've often gone back and made sure that, particularly when there's big dollars associated with it, that I'm double checking myself. And I've had a pretty good experience doing that. So I guess that would be the most difficult part of it.
Now you're wearing a couple of hats too. I mean, you're not just the lawyer; you are also the in-house investment banker, the corporate development guy at your company as well. Maybe just real briefly, what kind of deals are you looking at? I mean, you mentioned that you've been public about your acquisition strategy, and who are you competing with? Is it the private equity? Is it the strategics? Is it both? I mean, you mentioned it's a $4 billion space that you're in right now, so.
So John,
who are the folks that are looking to buy?
So John, this is a space worldwide that is more like 10 billion, maybe 12 billion. And there are major private equity players that are involved in this and working in the roll-up space. So they are one of our primary competitors. We have a strategic that has a very strong presence in Europe, a company called Trescal. They are trying to grow their presence through an acquisitive strategy in the United States and in North America. And so I bump up against them. I bump up against private equity. The types of deals we're doing, we're still relatively small in a lot of if you sort of look at our balance sheet and our P&L. So my role was when I first started with Transcat, it was as an outside counsel, the kind of deals they were doing were very small, but they moved the needle for a company that's time that might be doing $50 or $60 million in revenue. As you start moving towards the $200 to $300 to $400 million revenue goal, getting to move that needle, you can't do it in $2 and $3 million acquisitions. So we completed our largest acquisition. In August of this year, and it was a $30 million acquisition of a company that provides asset management services. It's really kind of ancillary to what we do, but they're in the life sciences space. They do asset management, and that asset management, particularly when it comes to pharmaceutical companies, lends itself to cross-sell the calibration services we provide. They've also got a geographic presence in the EU. They're in Ireland. So yes, I will have an opportunity to go to Ireland, and I'll take pictures and send them.
The old stuff.
So that was our largest acquisition. Just to give you some perspective, was $30 million. So not huge, right? We believe, and we've already told this publicly, that we will do more of those. And We have, anyway, early reviews from the market, and you know, when market can be fickle, is that the market has been relatively pleased with what we've been doing.
Great. Well, listen, as somebody who's done a lot of deals and is working both on the legal side and on the business development side, obviously there are red flag issues that everybody can see in a transaction, you know, financial fraud or you know, big contingent liability issues, that type of thing. Other than that kind of stuff, what are the things that come up during the diligence process or the bidding process that will cause you to think twice about moving forward with a deal?
You know, that's a really good question, John. And the most obvious of them are, so we model our deals in a way that we are required to generate a specific IRR as a result of that acquisition. And we plug that into a model. Things that generate red flags for us, in that model often are pay practices. I'll run across a lot of entrepreneurs, have no idea what the Fair Labor Standard Act's about and pay their people however they want to pay them. And those generate real issues from us just from a cultural perspective, because, you know, as we both know, you can pay a non-exempt employee however you want to pay them, but you got to pay them overtime. And the entrepreneurs of the world think that, you know what, if I don't have anybody collect their hours and I know they're non-exempt and that type of a thing, and I lock my doors at 4 o'clock, I don't have any problems. Well, we both know that's not necessarily the case. So and then culturally, the problem with that is you take an employee and say, I'm gonna have to pay you a little differently. And what ends up happening is, particularly when you're dealing in the world of techs and technicians that provide calibration services, their response to that is not positive. So the pay practices become a problem. And then for us, quality. There's a joke around the industry that there are businesses out there, they're called lick and sticks. They basically put the sticker on and certify the calibration without doing the calibration. And it's very easy to pick up on that in the context of due diligence. So, and sometimes the customers want it that way. They just want to, you know, close their eyes and ignore that. But, you know, when you're in high failure kind of businesses where you're dealing with rockets in space and vaccines and human beings, you don't want that risk of failure to be anything but as a result of something that was done properly. So those are kind of the two red flags that we'll run across, where it's, you know, it's either a quality issue, it's an employee issue. The obvious things, obviously, as you mentioned, some of the legal stuff, but those are the two, I think, that are the big red flags for us.
Now, listen, we talked about two roles here. How do you balance that in a deal? To me, that's got to be awfully tough. I mean, you're wearing your dealmaker hat. You're supposed to be the guy with a little dry powder, and you're also in the legal front.
Right.
That's a tough situation to be in, I would think.
So what we try to do is, very early on, I will explain to the potential target or seller or owner how our process works. And, first, I don't get paid based on any kind of, deals I generate. That would really generate a bad conflict. And it's something that I have been very sensitive to. But we have an acquisitions team that comes in, and we actually have a deal team and a deal committee that ultimately makes the decision. And I actually let the sellers know that, look, I am going to petition on your behalf this transaction, and then I'm going to turn it over to my deal team, and I'm going to drive the legal side, and you're going to deal with them, and you probably won't see me again until the closing, because I'm going to be interacting with your lawyers, and I am going to turn immediately from the sales guy selling you on Transcat to the risk guy, making sure Transcat doesn't take on too much risk. And it's a interesting conversation to have with a seller. Some are more sophisticated than others and understand that. Others, struggle with it. And it does make it more difficult to acquire what I would call sort of a smaller business when somebody doesn't quite understand that potential conflict.
That's that's an interesting situation, and it is it's interesting the way that your company has sort of set it up to kind of address it, and you have the deal team, and you do the preliminaries and go out to dinner and wine and dine.
I do the best part, John. Right, I get to have Jameson on rocks and a steak. Come on.
Yeah, that's, where do I sign up for that part of the deal? I was always in the conference room at 3 a.m. with the flickering fluorescent light eating cold pizza from 6 p.m.
Very nice.
Yeah. Well, you've been there too, I know. You obviously don't do these deals entirely in-house. You have outside counsel that you use. And I think this is important. Again, we have a mix of in-house and outside counsel. And I think one of the things outside counsel are always interested in hearing and in-house counsel are always interested in telling are the things that they like about their outside counsel and the things they do and the things that just drive them nuts. So maybe you could talk about each one of those.
I can. The things that I like about outside counsel, and let me say, I'm incredibly partial to my former firm. I'm working with the same gentleman who, you know, was 3 or 4 years behind me as an associate and became a partner 3 or 4 years after I did. He's one of the best M&A lawyers I've ever worked with. As an aside, you know, my former partner in the labor space is now coming over to join me as VP of HR. So it's, you know, it's a pretty friendly atmosphere and it's people that really respect one another. So let me say that on that end, the practicality of an M&A lawyer and the understanding of scalability of risk or lack of scalability of risk, I think is an important component of being a good M&A lawyer. And the guy I use fully understands that.
Could you drill down on that just a little bit as to what you're talking about when you say scalability?
Well,
I think it's an important concept.
So, I'll give an example. You know, I once had a lawyer on a transaction tell me that they're very concerned that the company we were acquiring had utilized some of the company's stock as part of the 401k investment and in contravention of the 401k plan. And I said, okay. I said, how many shares are we talking about? Four. I said, okay, that isn't a risk. Okay, that's a foot fault, and we can figure out how to pay somebody the $89 back that they need for the four shares. That drives me crazy. Okay, if you can't understand that that's a risk that's probably worth taking. Okay, and that's where I think the folks that I work with really understand that. And I don't spend a lot of time having to worry about the risk that isn't really a risk. Okay. So that's sort of, my favorite example of that because it happened pretty recently. The other sort of thing that drives me crazy is you can't do that. You can't do that. You can't do that. And with no alternative method of addressing, you know, I need to get down that road. I recognize I can't get off this exit, but are you telling me I can't go anywhere? So the mantra that I have told, my friends on the outside is, there's a couple words I like to hear. Okay. I like to hear, okay, if the answer is not yes, then the answer is no. And then I want to know why. So no, because, and then, but you could do it this way. If you can live with those three words, no, because, but, I'm going to be a happy camper. If you stop at no, I mean, anybody can say no. So that has been my pet peeve. I don't see it too much, but I see it occasionally.
Yeah, I've talked and written about the lawyer who goes to. In my example, has always been in the boardroom where the man or woman sits there at the end of the table and says, on the one hand, you could do this, and on the other hand, you could do this, and here are the risks of this, and here are the risks of this. Thank you. How about giving me a recommendation?
Yeah, here's what
give me some professional advice.
Here's what I would do. If I were in your shoes, I'm thinking this is what I would do.
Right.
So.
Oh yes, I think that's a common complaint from in-house counsel, and I think more and more. You know, when I was younger, I ran into a lot of lawyers like the one that I just mentioned, and I think it was simply because the competition wasn't what it was now. I mean, now you've got everybody breathing down your neck, and you either get good or you get out.
Yeah.
Because you're not gonna get any work. So, but I think that's still a really great. Point. And this is, it's sort of a segue to the next thing, which is, you know, what do you do, in terms of really adding value as a lawyer to your client? What's kind of I'll pick this lawyer over this lawyer every time because I can always count on him or her to do this. I mean, what are the big value?
Yeah, for me on the M&A front, it has always been a practical approach to risk. The whole goal in an M&A in a transaction is to sort of properly apportion the risk and understanding risk and understanding the reasons for a transaction. And I can be fairly prickly about things on a transaction, particularly when I'm paying a significant multiple for a company. So the lawyer that I most enjoy working with is the one who understands that there are times when Jim is going to be difficult because Jim is paying a crazy multiple for a business. And there are times where Jim is saying, you know what, I'm getting this one for probably a little less than I probably thought I was going to get. And so the risk reward component of this is a little different.
You have a bigger cushion.
Yeah. So that's sort of the best M&A lawyers, I think, understand that and understand it pretty quickly.
Now, one of the things I want to touch on here before we close off is, you know, in addition to the positions you have at Transcat, you're also an outside director of another NASDAQ company and also of a SPAC, which is interesting. Maybe you can tell me how your role as a director has sort of helped you in your role as a corporate officer. What are your takeaways from being a public company director?
You know, John, I think, you know, both of us, I think, have been around the corporate boardroom for quite a long time. So I'm very comfortable sitting in the boardroom. I almost want to think about that question in the other instance. And that is because I have been on the inside and on a different side of the table of the board, I find myself as a board member feeling a level of empathy for the professional that is trying his or her best to protect me in the best manner that they possibly can, and recognizing that is not always the easiest thing in the world to do. I have been incredibly fortunate at Transcat. I have some of the smartest, most flexible, and well-experienced people on my board, and they're from all. There's several CEOs. There's bankers. There's HR, private equity. And so we've got a lot of talented, diverse people on our board right now that make my job pretty easy. I have a chairman who frankly was a client of mine before I came to Transcat. It's Rochester, right? So our kids played lacrosse together and we've known the families forever. And so we trust one another it's a really terrific relationship to that end. But on the other side, as a board member, I see how tough it can be because I've been in the chair of some outside counsel who's trying to counsel a board, in a time when, you know, when I was on Lakeland, I first joined the Lakeland board. We had a lawsuit in Brazil that we lost, and it turned our balance sheet upside down immediately. So we went to a going concern. We had the bank immediately call our loan, and we had to scramble. And I felt pretty nervous myself, but I also understood how tough it was for the individual at the table with us counseling us. Mm-hmm. And by the way, we pulled out of that.
Apparently, you're still here. They're
still there. The only lesson I could take from that is don't invest in Brazil.
Now, are you free to talk about the SPAC? Kind of how you got into that?
Yeah. I mean, we just closed on it. I had my first audit committee meeting today, so we're filing our financial statements. I think
you just closed your D-SPAC.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So there's not a lot to really talk about at this point. I mean, we're just sort of getting started. Not a ton to talk about. I'm really kind of interested to see how this one goes. I've been invited to be on a number of SPACs. I've turned them down. The individuals on this board, I've got a guy from Lee Partners who's obviously incredibly bright, and I think views this as his public-private equity play, which I kind of do too in some ways. So we got a talented board, but it's still pretty early. How about that?
Yeah, you know, one thing about SPACs, and obviously there's a lot to criticize about SPACs.
Sure.
And people who read my blog know that I criticize a lot about SPACs. But you know, the comment that really just gets to me in is, you know, for the first time since the mid to late 1990s, the smaller companies have a viable path to the public markets. Mm-hmm. And that's really what, you know, SPACs may be very dysfunctional and it may be a symptom of an underlying problem, but, you know, you saw an explosion last year in the last couple of years of IPOs from the kind of companies that you and I spent the early part of our careers taking public all the time in the traditional way.
Right. You're absolutely right, John.
So it's just an interesting thing.
Yeah. No, it is. I'm sort of chalking this one up right now as a learning experience. I haven't done this. I mean, I used to do those SPACs back in the 90s. They were very different. And they were a very different group of people that were doing them.
Have most of them got out of prison yet, Jim? Yeah, I am about out of questions, but I appreciate your time.
Who mom loves more or who is the better football player?
Well, we all know the answer to that is Jason, of course. I got to say, because she's going to be here Thanksgiving and I'm going to show her this. So I have to say, Mom, we know that's not true and that you love us all equally. Because she'll get mad. I mean, you did that on social media once, and she fired both barrels.
She sure did. Well, I love you, Mom.
Anyway, our youngest brother, Jason, and one thing I'm very glad is that I control the password to the Deal Lawyer site, and there ain't no way we're going to show him this, because the tuning up that Jim and I would get from our youngest brother would just be completely merciless. So.
Thank you for not doing that.
that's in our mutual best interest, right. Jim. I will show it to Mom. So I think the best thing that we can do to close this off today is, first of all, thank everybody for listening and putting up with the silliness here. And I hope you enjoyed it. And you know, if you're interested in doing this, I'd love to have you. As you see, it doesn't have to be. If you've got something legal you want to talk about, I'm happy to talk about that with you. If you've got some stories you want to tell, if you want to just talk about what you do, I'm all ears. And I think you'd be surprised how many other people will be all ears. But to close this off today, I think, Jim, you and I have to do what everybody does in every football game we ever watch when the camera goes on them. And that's wave their hands and say, hi, Mom. Hi, Mom. Hi, Mom.
Take care, John.
So. You too, Jim. Thanks very much.
Thanks. Bye-bye.